Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Sneha Annavarapu, the host of this channel, and today I have the honor of being in conversation with Dr. Saiba Verma, author of the book The Occupied Clinic, Militarism and Care in Kashmir, which was published by Duke University Press in October 2020. Congrats, Saiba, on this beautifully written, moving, and very thoughtful book, and thanks for joining me and us on the podcast today.
Thanks so much, Sneha. It's really a pleasure to be here.
And really, the pleasure is all mine. And, I thought we could start the conversation with you telling us a little bit about yourself, perhaps how you became an anthropologist.
Sure. So I grew up the child of a diplomat. My father was an Indian diplomat. And so we moved around. We lived in a different country, every 4 years or so. And I grew up kind of with this feeling, although of course I didn't have the language for it at that time, but just this feeling of, being dislocated, not really quite belonging, either in India or either, in the countries that we lived in. And when I went to college, I came to college in the US, and it was there that I, first kind of encountered like intersectional feminism, Kiran Narayan's work and Mary John and Kamla Visvesvaran. And I was just blown away that there was actually a language to talk about my own experiences, other people were also not just feeling sort of what I was feeling, this kind of sense of being out of place or being like multiply sort of dislocated, but that there was a theoretical language for it as well. And so that really, I would say, was what kind of drew me to anthropology. And in my first semester of college, actually, 9/11 happened. And it was sort of like overnight, the world just shifted, right? And I think it was, in many ways, a kind of political awakening for me. I was taking an introduction to anthropology seminar, and my professor just like threw out our entire syllabus. And he was like, we are just going to spend this entire semester thinking about Islam and thinking about the kind of history of relation between Islam and the West. And that was also a really profound kind of moment for me, that there was a discipline that was like so willing to kind of respond to like these global events of this magnitude, and that we could actually like think about what was happening right in front of us as it was unfolding. So I think those were the two kind of experiences that really drew me to anthropology. I mean, I still thought like being an anthropologist was like a fantasy job. it didn't seem like real to me at all. But my teachers, my professors and even my parents really like encouraged me to pursue it because I think they knew how passionate I was about it.
Yeah, I mean, the way you're telling the story is also very ethnographic. So perhaps they really sense this ethnographic sensibility in the way you were thinking about these events and connecting them to broader, like global processes, thinking about your own place in the world in this critical way. And that's really interesting. And which really makes me even more curious then to ask you, What is the story of this particular book, or how did this particular project unfold?
Yeah. So I think it, so I began kind of really interested in questions of violence sort of writ large, you know, in South Asia, and thinking about like the forms of displacements of, that violence produces. Mm-hmm. But when I sort of landed on Kashmir as a place that I wanted to work in, just because, you know, everything I was reading about it was like from this very Indian nationalist perspective or a Pakistani nationalist perspective. And mm-hmm. there was this like lacuna in the middle, which was like, what do Kashmiris themselves think about this mm-hmm. Conflict? And when I went, you know, as anthropologists do, we're like so desperate for anyone to talk to us, you know. So I just was calling people, finding contacts. And I met a couple of psychiatrists who basically told me, you know, I asked them, what do you think is the most pressing issue happening right now? And they were like, there is this epidemic of trauma. There is this mental health crisis. You know, 60% of people here are experiencing psychiatric distress that lasts their entire lifetimes. This is what you should work on. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, you know, can I shadow you basically for like 2 years? And they were like, yeah, it's fine. I was like, great.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, right? So many projects, I think, happen by accident like that.
Totally.
So that's kind of how it emerged. And I would say, like, I, you know, for my dissertation and everything, it was a pretty conventional medical anthropology project. You mm-hmm. know, it was situated in the clinic. It was in several clinics, like the kind of only government psychiatric hospital in the region, in a substance abuse clinic, and with these various NGOs who were doing sort of psychosocial work, like counseling and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was trying to understand, like, what forms of knowledge are being produced in these settings? How are people reacting to these very new forms of care in many cases? How does that, you know, maybe rub up against their own ideas of care, etc.? And I think it was fine, you know, as a dissertation project. But when I was done with it, I just felt so deeply kind of dissatisfied with my dissertation, which I know is a common feeling.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
but in my case, I felt like there was something that I had really left sort of incomplete, mm-hmm. like there was something unassimilated. And mm-hmm. I think that that was basically just a real reckoning with violence, with the scale of violence and with the ways in which violence really permeated like the everyday people's like psychic lives, their, you know, these most intimate kind of social relationships, and even my own identity and my work as a researcher and like what it meant to do field work. And I think part, you know, and none of this I really confronted in my dissertation because I really didn't know how to confront it. Like mm-hmm. part of it, I think, was my own fear and not knowing how to write about that immensity, you know, that immense kind of experience of conflict without right. falling into this trap of like, you know, what Val Daniel once called like a pornography of suffering,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't know how do I write about this trauma without holding myself up as an ethnographer, as this kind of, you know, witness extraordinaire or something, because I was very uncomfortable with the idea that I could somehow be a moral witness. You know, I was like, what what standing do I have, right, to be arbitrating here? And also just like contending with my own complicity as an Indian citizen,
mm-hmm.
sort of seeing, really being confronted with the forms of violence that the Indian state had perpetrated in this region. I didn't know how to put all of that together, or at least I wasn't able to put it all together in a dissertation. But for the book, it was something that I was really determined to do. I was really like, you know, determined to like confront all of that. And it meant like starting to write from scratch. It meant undoing a lot of what I had done or what I thought I knew. It meant unlearning you know, it meant like shedding all these layers of things I had been taught, both about Indian history, but also about like what it means to do anthropology, what it means to be present in these kinds of spaces of violence.
Yeah. You know, as I mean, I can't speak to the immensity of violence, of course, in my own project because it's a very different one. But the way you're talking about this transformation of the dissertation into the book, a lot of it, I guess, resonated because I think everybody does feel a sense of dissatisfaction with the dissertation. But precisely why, I think you articulated it so well. And I can't wait to think about some of the things that you've said while trying to draft like a book prospectus and stuff like that. So really, thanks for that. And let's get to the book itself. And so the book starts out with such a compelling argument, again, around militarism and care. That is, the current crisis in Kashmir is what is an outcome of what you call the overinvestments in care, rather than longstanding neglect by the state. Instinctively, of course, this resonates with anyone, I guess, remotely familiar with the toxicity of paternalistic protection, the saying that this is for your own good. But beyond that, you argue that loving Kashmir, in quotes, is key to understanding how Indian nationalism attains perfectibility. Can you speak a little bit about these longstanding libidinal logics of love?
Yeah, sure. So first, I mean, I think I should just say that, you know, it's so difficult to capture the sort of just the affective intensity, right, of this relationship. I think I think South Asians get it, like, because we've grown up with this. But for those who are unfamiliar with the region, just the ferocity, right, of this kind of like obsessive love and desire.
Yeah.
For this place, it's really, I think, hard for people to wrap their heads around. I was thinking, like, you know, an analogy would be sort of like the American flag or something, right? As this like sacred symbol that connotes, like, right, all of this like sort of patriotic energy, and like kneeling in front of it, for example, is this like sacrilegious act. But, you know, even in the US, you have like progressive or liberal people who are okay with that, right? They understand like that impulse and where it comes from. Whereas in India, this love, this obsession for Kashmir really permeates like all parts of a political spectrum, right? It's like just so pervasive. There is no space to sort of critique Kashmir's place in the kind of Indian nation state, as well as this kind of imaginary. Yeah. So in terms of like this idea of overinvestments, I think what is interesting about Kashmir is that it's you know, often figured as this borderland. But whereas other borderlands, like we could think of the northeastern states of India, for example, that usually we think of as spaces of neglect or spaces of abandonment. Kashmir is really exceptional, right? In the sense that it's about over investments. It's about economic over investments. It's about humanitarian over investments, but it's also about military over investments. And so, you know, this all kind of has been mixed together, I think, in a really sort of shrewd combination, I would say, and one that's not always visible to ordinary Indians, right? So it's very common. I'm sure, you know, you've heard your parents say this as well.
Yeah.
But my parents, right, like people, they'll say like, oh, you know, we've showered them, quote unquote, with so much, and they're still so ungrateful, right? That these demands for political self-determination, in a sense, are not just illegible, but there's something kind of affectively wrong, right? There's something kind of morally offensive about them. And the ways in which the Indian state has sort of mobilized love and violence together remains like largely, I think, invisible to Indian publics. So I, you know, in kind of thinking about this, these relations of love and care, and the way then, of course, they become transformed more recently in the ways in which the Indian state is trying to sort of reconfigure itself as a therapeutic actor in the region, as a, you know, talking about the healing touch, right? Talking about like heart warfare, all of these kinds of things become ways of, I would say, not just disguising the violence that has always accompanied them, but even of producing new forms of harm, right? Because under that guise of care, you can actually then start doing more things to people. You can kind of extend the military apparatus so that civilians become involved, for example, through counterinsurgency and other practices.
I mean, that is it's tricky precisely, as you said, it produces new forms of harm rather than just disguising. And I think that's really well put. But in chapter one, you sort of peel the layers of a term that seems to be ubiquitous in Kashmir, that is kamzori. Mm-hmm. And you say that it's used to mean both a physical and psychological condition. It is at once individual and collective. And it's also a moral category linked to histories of colonialism and the contemporary ecology of corruption in the region. Mm-hmm. And you argue against a simplistic reading of kamzori as a cultural signifier. And instead, you show the existential, social, and political stakes of this really loaded term. And you take seriously the semantic complexity of kamzori, right? I would love it if you could speak a little bit to what doing this enabled you to learn and what it teaches us about militarism and medicine and the many connections between them.
Sure, yeah. Kamzori was like one of those, you know, ethnographic surprises that I found because, you know, before I started doing field work and also while I was in the field, you know, you're just like basically devouring everything you can, right, on your research topic. And everything I read was basically about trauma and PTSD. There was just this kind of profusion of literature on those subjects. And so when I began doing field work, I was imagining, you know, that these clinics would be sort of full of people with PTSD symptoms and you know, that it would be ubiquitous everywhere. And I soon realized that actually there wasn't that much PTSD. And that was a real shock and surprise to me. And of course, it wasn't because there was a lack of trauma or a lack of suffering. But as, you know, psychiatrists ended up sort of explaining to me, it was actually because the levels of kind of active conflict had decreased. And so incidence of PTSD had increased. Meanwhile, other forms of psychiatric distress, anxiety, and like major depressive disorder, and all of those things were on the rise. You know, because PTSD is something that is, you have to have like a very specific kind of external event that triggers it. It didn't really kind of map onto the kind of violence that was happening anymore in Kashmir. It was much more, you know, the violence had become much more dispersed. It was the slower kind of erosion of everyday life, the sense of uncertainty, the sense of lack of like futurity, those kinds of things. And so once I realized, okay, PTSD is not the object, you know, which again, this is like a pretty common experience. I think a lot of anthropologists have, like, I'm thinking about Lawrence Cohen, you know, in Noijing in India in the beginning, he talks about he's looking for he's looking for senility and he's like chasing down old ladies down alleyways. I think he describes it until he realizes that's an insane thing to do. You know? So it's kind of like a similar experience, you know, chasing PTSD and realizing, okay, hold on, that's not actually the thing. And so then I actually started paying attention to what people were bringing to the clinic, like what complaints. And that's when I sort of landed on kamzori and finding that kamzori was actually the ubiquitous thing that almost every patient who was coming to seek care was, you know, expressing that they were this feeling of kind of chronic fatigue, this like physical debility. But it was also more than that, you know, it was also a feeling of kind of social debility or moral debility, feeling like you were really not the same as you had been earlier, that there was this like eroding sense of yourself, of your, like, just your presence as a human being, you know, and it's like spiritual, moral, affective, all of those dimensions. And I was really interested that, you know, even when people were getting treated for kamzori or for other psychiatric, like just forms of distress, but they would kind of insist on that kamzori was still there. It wasn't something they were like willing to let go. And that also really fascinated me, is that why are people kind of insisting on kamzori? And I don't know if you've read this piece by Fanon. It's where he's talking about the North African syndrome. And he sort of describes how, like, from the perspective of these French colonial doctors, that, like, he says, like, the North African comes enveloped in vagueness.
Right.
Like, their bodies are just illegible to the doctors. And their bodies are read as kind of ineloquent. When in fact, right, that silence, that vagueness is saying so much about the kinds of conditions that people are living in. So as you pointed out, Sneha, like, I was really trying to draw attention to the materiality of kamzori and the ways in which it's kind of calling for this attention, right, to well-being as this kind of relational, moral, political, and spiritual process. And also historical, I realized that kamzori itself is kind of a colonial wound. That's what people are kind of theorizing it as. And through drawing attention to it, I think they're calling for a kind of decolonial healing, right? Like recognizing that these wounds are ongoing, they're unfolding, they're not just going to get fixed. And they're not easily locatable, right? They're like very much in the social. So those are kind of some of the things I was trying to draw attention to through kamzori.
Yeah, and, you know, on that note, the other term that I guess one often associates with Kashmir is the term disturbance, right? And in chapter two, you address rather directly this idea of disturbance. And first you show how in mainstream public culture, Kashmir has become sort of synonymous as a disturbed place. And this invocation of Kashmir as being disturbed justifies and reproduces military repression in many ways. However, as with all the quietly brilliant moves you make in this book, what I found really compelling is how you argue that disturbance manifests in the space of the clinic and how doctors are not co-opted by state logics, even while being embedded in them. Could you walk us through how this idea of disturbance shapes interactions at the clinic and how it presents opportunities for the disruption of militarism itself?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, so of course this this idea of disturbance, I mean, I'm thinking of it, you know, in the context of sort of the Indian, like Indian state occupation in which Kashmir, you know, in 1990 is declared officially, like legally and militarily declared a disturbed area. And along with a number of emergency laws that are instituted, right, is basically put under martial law, where it kind of remains until today, right? So these laws, these kind of anti-disturbance laws, if you like, which are meant to be temporary, become part of a kind of permanent infrastructure, this permanent kind of emergency infrastructure in Kashmir. And what I found that was interesting about disturbance was that people were, of course, using it to talk about all kinds of extrajudicial violence that had happened, right? That these emergency laws, for example, give cover to security forces to shoot on site, right? To do preventative detentions, to do all kinds of really aggressive military occupation operations, and they are protected, right, from prosecution, even when these kind of egregious human rights violations occur, which we know they have occurred systematically in the region. And so people were using, kind of questioning, of course, what is this technology of disturbance and what was it doing? But what I realized was kind of interesting was that the sense of impunity that had come about as a result of disturbance, it was no longer just the state that was acting with impunity, or it was no longer just the military or soldiers, but people were kind of theorizing the way that disturbance had like sort of infiltrated the social. It had kind of unleashed this ethical havoc you know, in everyday life, where everyone was behaving as if they had impunity, right? So there was a sense of kind of widespread corruption, these senses of like interpersonal mistrust, right? All of which kind of permeated into the clinic and into medicine as well, where doctors were extremely scared of patients. Like, I think that there's a moment in the book where I describe how doctors were describing patients as basically have, like, that they had taken on the spirit of rebelliousness that had come, you know, with occupation and with the kind of overturning of like the social world, essentially, where patients could, you know, if a procedure, for example, didn't go well, patients would attack doctors, right? Or their kin would attack doctors. So doctors were feeling this kind of intense sense of vulnerability. At the same time, patients were also feeling this intense sense of vulnerability. Like, how do we trust doctors? How do we know that, are they giving us medicine or are they giving us poison? There were all of these cases of like malpractice. And people were attributing all of these forms of disorder or disturbance to this kind of larger political disturbance, you know? So I think it was really, you know, I think it was important to sort of think about disturbance as something that was very much like embedded in the ordinary. It wasn't something that was just particular to these kind of exceptional, like legal mechanisms. You know, like Lauren Berlant has this, I think, very useful distinction between trauma as an event and, you know, what she calls ordinary disturbances, things that like spread throughout the life world, in everyday practices, like embodiment, you know, in dreams, in social relations. And so she, you know, she says, she kind of calls on trauma theorists to like think about not just specific events, but also atmospheres and environments. And I think this is really what people were trying to say, both through the idea of kamzori as well as the idea of disturbance, that this is sort of, it's like infused, you know, into our everyday lives.
Yeah, it's in the air, in
exactly.
a way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. What I really also was struck by is what you say in chapter four about NGOs, the role of NGOs providing psychosocial care in sites of trauma such as Kashmir. And as you were talking about trauma being sort of generalized and not looking at trauma as an event, I was curious to hear more about the role of NGOs in providing psychosocial care, right? Like, and in chapter four, you don't tell us a story about how humanitarian organizations fail to achieve objectives or a story about how they callously exclude populations through arbitrary determinations of worthiness. Instead, you argue that it is the relational, epistemological, and methodological challenges of doing and evaluating psychosocial work. But I also thought that, I guess it's a methodological challenge of also determining what is trauma and how to deal with it, right? Could you tell us a little bit about the motivations of these NGOs and how they shaped, and how these motivations shape the categorizations of people as patients? And it would be great if you could perhaps share one instance of when these medical categories were subverted, pointing to their innate fragility in sites of generalized trauma, so to speak.
Sure. Yeah, I think, your question is like so, it's really on point. Before, I guess I want to add a little bit of background to it, if I can, just in terms of, you know, one of the things you sort of asked was also thinking about humanitarianism as well, right, through this question. And so, you know, I think like so much work in anthropology, right, on humanitarianism has focused on the kind of the ways in which humanitarian interventions are these processes of like radical subjective transformation, right? So if you think about like work coming out of Haiti or just conditions of like, let's say, asylum seekers or refugees who have to rely on these humanitarian apparatuses in order to to receive recognition, often they are transformed, right? It, from mm-hmm. being like political actors into, you know, what anthropologists will call victims, right? Or they have to learn how to tell their stories in particular ways. They have to really like dilute their identities. And I wanted to sort of, well, it's not so much I wanted to push against that, but I realized that my material didn't fit that, right. that story, you know? And that was because both, I think, psychosocial care in particular is such a different kind of humanitarian care than, let's say, offering like residency to somebody, right? Or offering asylum to somebody. It was such an inadequate, such a piecemeal form of care to begin with that I think in a way it allowed people to resist and push back against it in a lot of ways where, you know, I think if someone is offering you residency, you know, in a country, like you're not gonna, it shrinks, right? Your capacity to be an agent in that space. But here, since anyway, it was like hardly, you know, it was hardly anything. It was counseling or it was like receiving some emergency kit. People were, these encounters were much more fraught and much more surprising. And so I realized I had to kind of theorize what was happening in them in a kind of different way than what some of the other literature on humanitarianism was, you know, had kind of led us to believe that these are these like, you know, totalizing processes of transformation. So what I found interesting, I mean, so, you know, these psychosocial organizations, I really feel for them. Right. At the same, I mean, I have a very ambivalent relationship to them. Yeah. On the one hand, I think a lot of them are trying to do like really difficult work, right? They're trying to like fill in the gaps of a public health system that is completely overwhelmed, really under-resourced, where psychiatrists mm-hmm. don't have time to have these in-depth conversations with patients. And so here you have these organizations that are trying to like provide a kind of meaningful interaction where they're really kind of developing like ethical listening skills and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I feel like they're doing some really, really important work. Where I think some, though not all, of the organizations kind of, you know, struggled or fell short was mm-hmm. in their sort of effort to transform, you know, what they thought was like the the psychic life of people in Kashmir, right? Where they thought like people have zero understanding of mental health care. And so we're entering this like blank slate, you know, and we have to like create, we have to educate people into what depression is and what you know, what counseling is and those kinds of things. Not recognizing, of course, that people have all kinds of coping mechanisms and have for a long time, and that it's just in a different language, right? It's a different idiom. So that was always a little bit frustrating. But on the other hand, I found the encounters between patients and these NGOs so fascinating because, like I said, they were always full of negotiations. So, you know, like a typical counseling encounter, like session I would sit into, you know, the counselor would spend like 20 minutes just explaining what counseling is to a person, you know, and then the patient would listen, blah, 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 and then they would have their exchange. And then at the end, the patient would say, okay, great, can I have my medicine, you know? And counselors would be like, no, you know, this is not what it's about. And it was just this dance kind of over and over again. And so it was just interesting to kind of think about the illegibility of this particular form of care. And that actually receiving kind of biomedical care, like, you know, pills, etc., was way more culturally sort of legible to people. Than sitting and like talking to a stranger for an hour. So there were all these kind of really interesting dynamics, you know, at work in these organizations.
That's, I remember being very struck by what you said in the chapter about how organizations were selling a sort of like a worldview of an inner transformation of the Kashmiri mindset, so to speak. And yeah, it was very interesting that you paid attention to that too. And it's something that I guess ethnography offers in a way, right? That other forms of gathering information about what's going on in these spaces, that it would just completely miss this sort of subtle messaging that's going on there.
Exactly. And I think what was comical was its sort of failure to actually produce that transformation in a lot of cases, you know. But just because I think had they been offering something really, you know, something that people really wanted, I think people would have played along with the script. But because it was, there wasn't really any, the gift wasn't that appealing. You know, the effort at subjective transformation, I think really, they really struggled at that.
That's very interesting. I'm going to be thinking about this for a while. I attended a lot of counseling sessions of a very different kind in my field work, where traffic policemen were trying to counsel drivers without licenses or drivers that had been drinking and driving into becoming better drivers. And it was something, it's a very different context, but like the narrative around counseling, I think, was always like, just tell us what to do. You know, I'll pay the fine. I don't want to sit here and listen, which is interesting in its parallels, I guess. But so in the final chapter of the book, you do, I think, in a way, explore two events, right? Mm-hmm. You explore the 2014 flood in Kashmir, the worst, in quotes, natural disaster to have hit the region in over 50 years. And you track the Indian state's response to it and how this response was covered in popular mainstream media in India. In a sense, we go back to what the book started out with, broadly speaking, this desire for a rosy imaginary of civilians and military cooperating with each other and trusting each other. And you argue that the most acceptable form of Indian-Kashmiri relationality is the latter's complete deference, that militarized care is not altruistic, but actually very deeply conditional. And then you pivot to the second event, which was in 2016, when Burhan Wani, a young Kashmiri militant leader, was assassinated by the Indian security forces. And it also coincided, I guess, with your own visit to the region, right? Like after dissertation research had been done and so on.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about how these two crises, the floods in 2014 and the assassination in 2016, are related, and how hospitality and humanitarian care factored into making life possible in Kashmir in the aftermath of these two crises?
So as I described in the book, how basically I returned to Kashmir in 2016, which was, you know, after a gap of a few years. I wasn't there during the floods. And, you know, I was in Delhi, and already the kind of mass uprising after Burhan Wani, who was this young Kashmiri militant, was killed by Indian security forces in the summer of 2016. You know, there were already mass uprisings. The whole region was already sort of under curfew and lockdown, etc. But, you know, because I was in Delhi and because I'm a stubborn person, I was like, no, I don't care. I'm going. I have to go. And so I went. And of course, immediately, and even my friends in Kashmir had said, like, don't come. You know, you're not going to be able to do anything. Don't come. But I felt, like this pull, you know, and this responsibility or whatever it was that I wanted to go. And so I went, and of course, immediately all my fieldwork plans turned to dust, you know.
Right.
It was impossible to do anything because it was, at that time, the most severe lockdown I had ever experienced. And I had, you know, been there through 2010 and other periods of protest as well. But it really felt like something, the earth had kind of shifted. And, you know, now, of course, looking at it retrospectively, it seems almost quaint, right, when we think about what's happened in the last year or so. But what this I mean, what this moment did of 2016 was, again, because it was in lockdown, you know, it was, this space of disturbance. What it did was it really allowed people to open up and tell stories. And I think that's one of the things about disturbance as well, just coming back to your earlier question too, was, you know, that it's often we think about disturbance as these like very spectacular incidents of violence and like bombs and, you know, things like that. But a lot of times the disturbance was more like this kind of quietening down, or kind of like emptying of the everyday. You have like nothing to do. You have nowhere to go. You have, you know, no one to talk to. You're just hanging out, just kind of waiting, right? You're in this like space of liminality. And that's actually really good for ethnography in many ways. People like are more than happy to tell stories during those times. And what I found really interesting was that people began telling me a lot of stories about the floods in 2016. And so they themselves were kind of making a connection between what was happening in 2016, which for them was, you know, this such a clear sort of sign of the Indian state's its hypocrisy, its like, right, this complete disjuncture between its claims of care and love, and then on the other hand using pellets, right? Using pellets on civilians, and which people in Kashmir like repeatedly said were, these are like to be used on animals, you know? So this kind of like claim that, oh, we are like using these more sophisticated and softer forms of militarism. And then on the other hand, you have like, you know, by the end of the 2016 protests, 15,000 people have been like injured with these, with these non-lethal weapons. So that sort of disjuncture was so sharp. And I think that's what people sort of were relating to when they were talking about 2014, because that was another moment in which there was this really sharp disjuncture between representation and reality, right? So after the 2016 floods, like the Indian media, the right, everything was kind of like, pardon the pun, but like flooded with images of, you know, rescue and relief and these helicopters and soldiers like bravely crossing these rivers and, you know, rescuing people and all this stuff. And people told me, you know, that that was actually not at all what happened, that the army like rescued its own camps, rescued tourists, and then rescued some of its informers, collaborators, and then everyone else was left abandoned. And so both of these moments, just 2 years apart, were, I think, these really moments in which like this idea of abandonment really crystallized, at the same time as they were seeing the way the state was kind of making these claims of care and attention and all of that, right? And of course, like, abandonment though was not the, like, that was not the final kind of result on the ground. People fought back against it in all kinds of ways. And this is where, you know, hospitality and kind of mutual aid, you know, what I think we're seeing now as well in the US, this like burgeoning kind of mutual aid movements really came up. So in 2014, you know, neighborhoods self-organized, mosques organized food, water, all of these like basic necessities. Young boys went house to house, checking up on people, delivering food. And the same thing happened in 2016. People organized, they supplemented the public health system, which was again totally overwhelmed by these like, you know, just injured protesters coming, like waves after waves of injured people coming. They set up tents outside the hospital, taking care of like families, taking care of patients. And people kind of connected both of these events through this language of hospitality or mehman nawazi, and just saying like, look, we know how to take care of each other. You know, we don't actually need this, this Indian state to create this like forced dependency. We're actually perfectly capable of creating these forms of infrastructure for ourselves. And that was just a really powerful example for me of how these practices of self-determination, it wasn't just a political horizon, but it was like something that was happening in the present. You know, people were actively doing it and actively sort of showing each other, look, we can be interdependent. We can kind of determine our own fates, right? Our own lives. We can take care of each other. So it was just a way of sort of pushing back against, you know, this idea that we need the state to care for us more. That wasn't really the narrative. It was like, actually, leave us alone. You know, we can do this. We're going to show you just how beautifully we can do this.
Yeah, I could see that even in the writing, the voice of the people who were saying this, right? That came through really clearly and very strongly. And well, what I really loved about the book was also your reflexive and candid writing about your fieldwork. And you've already shared a little bit about how you got into it, the various ethnographic serendipities and surprises that guided you along. But I was hoping that you would be able to share with our listeners the sort of embodied adjustments you made while doing fieldwork in a militarized context as a non-native anthropologist, right? And I'm thinking specifically of a moment in your fieldwork during a time of heightened sieges and curfews where you asked of yourself, was I becoming Kamzor too? And I thought that was like such a, I mean, I remember marking it over and over again. And I guess in the context of our conversations until now, I'm curious about the learning curve in a setting where, as you yourself candidly put forth in the book, the very point of writing a dissertation sometimes seems futile.
I think, this is sort of like what I was gesturing to earlier as well, in terms of, you know, not really being able to grapple with what the effects of doing this work were on myself while I was going through it. I think I was performing the role of the ethnographer and feeling like, yes, I have mastery over this material. And of course, I can objectively describe these processes that are going in. Not that I believe in objectivity, but, you know, that I could be somehow standing outside of them and I could, you know, describe them in a reflexive way, but still, you know, still be able to kind of comment on them as something external to myself as well as ethnography. And I think by the time I started writing the book, I was finally ready to acknowledge some of the ways in which militarism and violence had seeped into me, you know, and had seeped into my fieldwork. There were all of these silences. There were all of these gaps in my field notes, things that I was really ashamed of. You know, so for example, at the beginning of my field work, you know, I would really like resist this idea of, you know, there would be a curfew or something, but it wouldn't be such a strict curfew. And so I would have this like kind of sense of bravado and I'd be like, of course, I'm going to go to the clinic, you know, I'm going to make use of this day and I'm still going to be productive, even though everyone else is telling me to stay at home and everyone else is perfectly okay staying home. And I would really push against that, you know. And I realized that that was partly like an inability to truly contend with, again, how like violence had sort of eroded people's capacities over time. And the deeper I kind of got into the fieldwork, the more I became, you know, I sort of became immersed, or that militarism kind of became a part of what I was doing. It became inescapable in a sense. So the, you know, the moment that you talk about of was I becoming Kamzor too was a, you know, was the kind of the moment, I think, in 2010 when, you know, there were like 3 months of nonstop protests over the summer, where at some point I just decided I wasn't going to fight against it anymore. And I was just going to succumb. I was just going to succumb to the temporality of disturbance, of slowing down, of not really doing field work, quote unquote, just like staying in my room, you know, letting myself really feel the effects of the curfew on my body, feeling claustrophobic, you know, all of those sensations. I really like let myself kind of go through that. And I think that was so important. Later on, I realized that this was, you know, of course, I had been like drawing a lot on like feminist ethnography and stuff, my whole, you know, my whole graduate career and things like that. But, you know, much later, I read Jean Fabre Sada's book on witchcraft. I don't know if you've read it, but it's really wonderful. And she has this concept called being caught, like being affected. Because she describes like going to doing her field work in this small village, and how no one was willing to talk to her about witchcraft until she got bewitched herself. And then suddenly people were like, okay, now you know. now we can talk to you. It was a very similar experience for me, where I felt like, okay, now I'm caught in this. Mm-hmm. Now I am, you know, I'm like spinning in the way that other people are spinning in the situation. And I really wanted to capture that in the book. Part of it was my own effort to kind of like confront it and overcome it, I think, you know, by writing about it. But I also know that a lot of anthropologists don't write about these things, and they skip over these experiences because it is, right? Like, you do feel like I failed. Like, what am I doing reading a novel in my room?
Right.
Making the most out of every day in the field, you know?
I mean, in a sense, it's also like this weird quantitative hangover, right? Of like capturing, or I don't know, like number of hours or minutes that you spend. I mean, there's a way in which, even without explicitly saying that it's quantitative, there is like the number of months you spent, or there are these measures that we take for granted as bestowing some kind of legitimacy on what you do. Because I guess the worry is the other extreme, right? Where like you just don't actually do any ethnography, but write an entire book on it. But yeah, I mean, I can, I really appreciated the way you wrote your place in the field for this reason, because especially some of the moments of doubt or, you know, mistranslation of some kind of conversation and the way you dealt with those moments was really instructive, I think, even to teach with. I found that really helpful.
Thanks. I think it's that huge, it's a huge kind of positivist hangover as well, right? Of just feeling like we have to present ourselves as authorities somehow in the face of this, when, you know, we're so, our whole being is kind of reshaped by these experiences.
Absolutely. I mean, in sociology, the discipline that I am in, I'm often asked how many hours I spent in the field, which I find very, very funny. I did not keep a log at all. I did not know that that was necessary, but it's like genuinely offered up as a question. How many hours did you clock the field? Yeah. So it's kind of why I really appreciated also the writing, because it says if there's less in anthropology, there's even less of this in Soch. So yeah. But you know, as a reader, I was also very taken by how you used poetry and photographs and in the book. And I think these helped open up different possibilities of accessing the material in the book. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on how you were able to use such a lyrical and poetic mode of writing ethnography, and whether it was a conscious choice to render your material legible in this sense.
Thanks for that question. I mean, it was definitely a conscious choice. You know, I think like, I have to sort of remind myself that I am a writer first and foremost. And actually that's the identity that I sort of much prefer to just being an anthropologist, just because of, you know, my ambivalence towards a discipline and its history, you know, its embeddedness with colonialism and continuation of those, even the colonial forms of knowledge, right, that it continues to perpetuate. And of course, like, you know, even being a writer, but being an anthropologist, like there were all of these kind of brilliant, like, feminist ethnographers, right, in the 90s, who, I mean, I guess, you know, for me, those are the people I sort of grew up with, quote unquote, right, in grad school and for grad school, reading all of them, who really challenge and push the boundaries of what ethnography can be. I mean, looking back on those texts, it's such an amazing kind of flourishing, right, of experimental form. And so I knew that, like, when it came time for me to write a book, that I wanted to really hold on to the craft of writing in the book. And I really wanted to write a book that I would want to read. And I know that sounds like really simple, but, you know, when you're like writing an academic book, there are all these voices that are telling you to, like, just like let go of it. Like, you know, you don't need to think about the reader, just get it done. That like writing a book is really just a way of getting tenure. You know, there's just so many pressures like that, which I think dilute the craft of writing. And I really wanted to resist that because it was so important for me. I read a lot of fiction, you know, like I love poetry. These are like modes of expression that are just not just really important to me, but I think they tap into other parts of, like, they're just other ways of knowing, right? And other ways of sensing the world that I think are just so important for us. So I find it, you know, I think it's sad that we don't think about writing like more seriously as a craft, even in anthropology, even though it's our primary kind of way of communicating, right? Our ideas to the world. Like, we don't really teach ethnographic writing. You know, I think these are all really kind of sad things that we really need to rethink these as part of the sort of crisis of the discipline as well. And, you know, just also, Sneha, though, you know, like, this book was rejected so many times by so many presses.
I just find that so hard to believe. I mean, why would any press pass up on this? It makes no sense to me.
They did. People told me they hated the writing.
Oh my God.
they hated the style. They hated the, I mean, they wanted it to be much more like, you know, theory, capital T. And, you know, I think like there's still this kind of misrecognition, right, that ethnography is not theory, that writing clearly is easy, but actually it's so difficult, you know? I really was very conscious of every decision of what kind of theory do I want in the book and what kind of theory do I want in the footnotes. Like, you probably noticed that a lot of the theory is footnoted, and that's deliberate because I wanted to maintain the readability. I wanted to maintain like the sense of lyricism that, you know, I found in everyday life in Kashmir. I didn't want academic knowledge to be the only kind of knowledge that was being presented. So I sort of really, I really like deliberated over those choices. And, you know, I want people to know that you should think about all of those. Those are all conscious choices, right, that we make as writers. And we can, I think those are ethical and also political decisions that we should consider. So,
And moving away from, I guess, this compulsiveness of moving forward with one's career alone, but, like, you know, also like doing something that you've spent so much time thinking about, like writing it up in a manner that is satisfying to you is, I think, really, really important. I'm still very surprised that presses would reject something like this, because honestly, it's, I guess it's fine to say this, but like, few books are, I think, read cover to cover by me. And this was certainly one of them. And I finished it so quickly, precisely because every chapter was just so engaging, and I really couldn't put it down, which is, I think, very high praise for an academic book. So, you know, well, as they say, their loss. But
Thanks for saying that. I mean, that means a lot, because you do have to trust your voice, you know, which is not, it's not easy in this business to do that.
Absolutely. So I mean that's I'm sure a lot of our listeners who are also writing, and I'm sure struggling with writing, especially this year, will be really glad to hear that, and it's a good reminder. I guess my final question to you, I've taken up a lot of your time, but I would really love to know what you're working on right now and what we can hope to see from you in the near future.
Sure. My projects are sort of, I guess, like everyone else's, in this kind of weird state of suspension where I'm working through some material like from 2016 around the pellet stuff, things like that. What I really want to work on next, you know, whenever I get to go to Kashmir next, which I hope is soon, maybe next year, is to really work on documenting kitchen gardens. For women, like a lot of women have kitchen gardens, they grow like vegetables and, you know, things for the family, but also those become really important during times of strike and curfew. They feed neighborhoods, they, you know, feed like entire communities. And so I really want to document just that kind of the practice of gardening and sort of, you know, not just survival, right? These are not just survival practices, but they're actually like nourishing, nurturing life. They're like ways that people are thriving in these conditions. So that's what I'm hoping to do next. And even just thinking about it makes me happy. It feels so hopeful in this moment. And I mean, everyone's gardening now, I guess, in COVID time.
Right, that's true.
So maybe we will learn some, you know, some really like cool new practices of gardening from that project.
Yeah. In a sense, it just, I guess it's like a very visible reminder of the potency of the soil, right? Like, and that's like such a beautiful image in that sense, of things thriving, growing, being nourished, but also nourishing us in very interesting ways. And that, the next project sounds really, really interesting. And I hope you get to go to Kashmir soon and do this work. And I, again, don't want to take up more of your time, but I really do want to thank you for taking time out and chatting with me today. Again, loved your book and loved this conversation, and I'm sure our listeners will be very thrilled.
I did as well, Sneha. Thank you so much, and thank you for all the really amazing questions. Awesome. Really loved chatting to you.
Yeah, take care, and you know, stay safe, as they say nowadays.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.